You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to an expert about the time-worn skill of blacksmithing. Now, Friday was the first debate in the race for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin. Incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson faced off against Democratic challenger Russ Feingold, repeating the matchup in the 2010 race for Senate in Wisconsin. Libertarian candidate Phil Anderson did not take part. Here are some highlights from the debate.
I've not been shy about disagreeing with our candidate, with our nominee, and certainly I'm not going to defend the indefensible.
I have supported Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, both. I said all along that I would happily support either one.
Obamacare is a massive consumer fraud.
Well, the fraud here actually is pretending that these problems didn't exist before the Affordable Care Act.
Paid family leave mandated by the federal government would increase the cost to those employers, not allowing them to have money to increase wages and benefits.
So people want the minimum wage raised, but they also want family leave, paid family leave. I believe it should be 12 weeks.
That was Senator Russ Feingold, or rather former Senator Russ Feingold, and incumbent Senator Ron Johnson from Friday night's debate in Green Bay. Dennis Dreesang joins us now to break down what happened. He's a professor emeritus of public affairs and political science at UW-Madison. Dennis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So this race between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold is a tight one. The polls show it tightening. We've got Feingold at 46%, according to the Marquette University Law School poll. We have Ron Johnson at 44, and Libertarian candidate Phil Anderson is polling at 4%. So given that backdrop, how important is a debate like last Friday's in a tight Senate race like this?
Well, at this point, most people have made up their minds, but since it is a tight race, the debate, I think, is very important, both in terms of providing some information for those people who have not made a decision one way or another, and for energizing the base. I think voter turnout is going to be very critical.
In last Friday's debate, the presidential candidates, they came up right away. And the big question there, how did Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson talk about their support of or their distance from their party's nominees, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
Well, Russ Feingold tried to isolate Johnson from the rest of, or not all of the Republican leaders, but the majority of Republican leaders, including his Senate colleagues who have come out and basically distanced themselves from Ron Johnson, I mean from Donald Trump. Johnson did give a somewhat balanced response on Trump by basically saying, there are things I agree with and there's behavior and language that I don't agree with. He still is vulnerable on that particular issue since he maintains an endorsement of Donald Trump. Most of the attention was, as usual, on Donald Trump rather than Hillary Clinton. I think that Johnson made a decent attack on Clinton, and Feingold had a very reasonable kind of response to defend his continued support for Hillary Clinton and for Bernie Sanders. And given the Democratic split, the fact that Bernie Sanders did so well in the primary, I think it was strategic for Feingold to mention that he also thinks that Bernie Sanders is a good person.
It's worth pointing out that, as you said, Ron Johnson does currently still hold an endorsement for Donald Trump, but he did not once mention the candidate's name, similar to House Speaker Paul Ryan last week. What do you think is the significance?
Actually, I don't think that is very significant. It's kind of symbolic that there's a certain amount of distance there, but I think we all know who he's talking about.
And you said that in terms of what Ron Johnson had to say about Hillary Clinton, there was an attack there, and Johnson brought up the question of trustworthiness. How did that play out?
Well, it's the main attack that Trump and other Republicans have had on Hillary Clinton. It's a general attack. It doesn't have a lot of specifics. When you start getting into specifics, There's much more in terms of accusation than evidence, but nonetheless, the circumstantial evidence that's there does raise some questions, and I think that probably those people who support Hillary Clinton wish that there wasn't that distraction.
Now, moving on to some of the issues on which they disagree, the Affordable Care Act came up in this debate. What did each of them have to say about that?
Well, Russ Feingold essentially said that there were some parts of the Affordable Care Act that needed to be improved and amended, and he was rather specific about the kind of improvements that he would favor. Ron Johnson really didn't talk very much about amending the Affordable Care Act, but rather, as he put it, going back in time and going to a position where we didn't have the Affordable Care Act. We could kind of start all over. And there was a theme that Ron Johnson mentioned there, as he did in a number of the other issues, which is that he's a libertarian. He's a Tea Party Republican who really wants to rely on the private sector, on market forces, and he's got this pretty consistent attack against government.
Incumbent Ron Johnson is chair of the Senate Homeland Security Committee. So what did Johnson and Feingold have to say about ISIS and about other national security issues on Friday?
Well, Ron Johnson mentioned his role in the Senate, although he mentioned it in more general kinds of terms, and then immediately kind of went into an attack on President Obama, again, in rather general terms, dealing with not just ISIS, but military and the like. Russ Feingold, who has a lot of experience from his previous time in the Senate, as well as what he's done since leaving the Senate, he's got a lot of experience in international affairs. And his response, I thought, was, to some extent, in a surprising way, pretty focused. He had several specific points and specific ways in which he would deal with the ISIS issue. And he didn't use that as an opportunity to talk in general national security kind of terms.
We're talking with Dennis Dreesing right now, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Political Science at UW-Madison. Looking back at last Friday's debate between Senate incumbent Ron Johnson and challenger Russ Feingold. And another topic that came up of interest in Wisconsin and also on a national scale, the candidates were asked about how to rebuild trust between police and the communities they serve, sometimes minority communities. And this was, of course, tied to two nights of unrest in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood that happened earlier this summer. What did the candidates say about that?
Well, actually, Ron Johnson didn't fully address that particular issue. He spent almost all of his time that he was allotted on that particular subject talking about the Joseph Project, which indeed is a very valuable and innovative kind of project, but it deals more with people who have been incarcerated and are now out of jail or prison. So he didn't really deal with the police shootings. Russ Feingold really focused on two kind of issues. One is supporting community policing, and which is a very common response of a lot of people to the police shootings, and talking about building trust within the community, and then talked more generally about institutional bias in not only policing, but housing and jobs and the like.
Another area of interest that came up during the debate, paid family leave, and a pretty stark difference there between the two candidates. How did they respond about that question?
Well, that was another opportunity for Ron Johnson to articulate his belief that we really ought to be focused on market forces, on letting businesses do what is best for the businesses, having government stay out in terms of programs and regulation and the like. Russ Feingold, on the other hand, he made a comment about minimum wage, which wasn't really germane to paid family leave, but then he did talk specific and forceful about paid family leave and pointing out a number of interactions he's had with people around the state. That so he brought some storytelling into his response, and then made a point which actually was made by the moderators or the panel as well, which is that the United States is rather unique among the Western countries in not having paid family leave.
And finally, Social Security was a hot topic in this election. What plan did each of the candidates lay out there in the debate to get at problems with that program?
Well, again, opportunity for Ron Johnson to talk about his libertarian and Tea Party kind of approach, relying on market forces and talking about the virtues of economic growth generally. Russ Feingold made it clear that he did not want to privatize Social Security, that he wanted to keep it as a public program, and had a specific recommendation, which is indeed one that a lot of economists suggest as well, and that is raising the cap on the amount of money each year that you pay Social Security taxes on, so that there wouldn't be a cap and people who earn at high levels of income would pay more, and we would generate more money for Social Security in that way.
Now, it sounds like this debate overall was a very civil debate, in contrast, I guess, with the last presidential debate. It does sound, though, that both candidates kept their focus on lines of attack that they've had for a while now. Johnson saying Feingold is a career politician without much to show for it, and Feingold saying Johnson is a pro-corporation against the working family. How did those various narratives about the candidates come out?
Well, I agree with you. I thought that we didn't have the kind of interruptions, we didn't have the body language, the demeanor that really did not show respect by the presidential candidates. That was absent in this particular debate, and credit to both candidates. I think that a theme that came through for Russ Feingold is a theme that he's had since he began in public office. He's very much in the Bill Proxmire kind of mode of relying a lot on contact with the people, going around the state. He had lots of stories, lots of linkages. He made a lot of his points in that way, talking about problem solving that gets generated from grassroots kind of interactions. Ron Johnson's theme that came through a number of times in almost half of all of the topics that were raised was this philosophy that he has that government is too big, we can't let government get bigger, government costs too much, we can't have more government spending, we really need to rely on businesses and market forces.
Dennis, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
That was Dennis Dreesing, Professor Emeritus of Public Affairs and Political Science at UW-Madison. He joined us to look back at Friday night's U.S. Senate debate in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll hear from two of the original founders of American Players Theater about how Shakespeare changed their lives. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here is executive producer Erica Janik.
There's a door on Menominee's Wilson Place Mansion that's more than just a door. As part of our ongoing look at the objects that tell Wisconsin's story, Jim Bryan tells us about the social responsibility, craftsmanship, and educational innovation behind that door.
I've been teaching history of design at UW-Stout for several years now and take my students to Wilson Place Mansion as a field trip. And since I'd first been there, had heard the story that it was crafted by students at the Stout Institute, which is now UW-Stout, as a gift to Senator Stout and his family, and that intrigued me. It's a large wooden door that looks very medieval. One of my colleagues said it should be on the set of The Hobbit. We can't prove definitively who made the door. There's not a signature, there's not a receipt, but I really think it's the work of Thomas F. Googerty, who taught summer school at the Stout Institute and was well known, not just in the Midwest, but around the country in arts and crafts circles in the late 1800s, early 1900s. James Huff Stout was, I think, the second generation of owners of Knapp Stout and Company, which was an enormous lumber concern. According to some sources, it was the single largest white pine lumbering operation in the world in its heyday. But as 1900 approached, it was really obvious that there wasn't a lot of timber left to harvest in this part of Wisconsin. And I think Stout felt a sense of responsibility towards his community to help prepare for the future. And I think that he saw innovative educational programs as a way to do that. They were very much interested in practical vocational skill sets, in students acquiring technical expertise to get jobs done, but they were also very interested in developing students' intellectual capacities. They made it very clear that developing technical skills and handicraft abilities involved intellectual development. So they were always connecting those two ideas. The door, it's significant evidence of people who have a sense of social responsibility making an investment in innovative programs meant to uplift the community, and then the community responding with appreciation. I will say that nowadays, many people seem to take a much more narrow philosophy as to what education is about. Many people conceive of education as simply vocational preparation and the acquisition of technical skill sets that employers are going to desire in employees. And James Huff Stout certainly understood that all of that was necessary, but he also believed that there was an aspect of enrichment and personal development that was essential.
This story was part of Wisconsin 101, a collaborative project to explore Wisconsin's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
The Wilson Place door also showcases wrought iron features that required the work of a skilled blacksmith. Joining us now to talk about blacksmithing is Dan Nauman. He's the owner of Bighorn Forge Incorporated and editor of the Artist Blacksmiths Association of North America magazines, The Hammer's Blow and The Anvil's Ring. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Veronica.
Well, can you first tell us how you got into blacksmithing?
Well, back in 1979, I took a class at a blacksmith shop in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, at the Cedar Creek Settlement. It was right next to the winery there, and the fellas there liked the way I swung the hammer, and they asked me to stay on, and so I worked there in exchange for knowledge, not so much for cash money, but built a shop in my folks' backyard, and took workshops specifically from a man by the name of Francis Whitaker out in Carbondale, Colorado. And he really set the stage for me to learn and produce architectural metal. And so in 1993, I quit my day job and went full-time into forging.
What is it about blacksmithing that you love now that this is your full-time job?
Well, the I guess first and foremost, it's you can make things from scratch, and I enjoy the immediacy of the material. It's very much like clay as it's hit with the hammer, manipulated with the hammer, and the array of styles is limitless. It's all based on classic design and basically your mind as well as you know, where you can push the boundaries of metal. And in today's world, you know, pushing the boundaries is being done more and more in this country and worldwide.
Are the same methods being used today that, you know, we think of with blacksmithing, you know, centuries ago?
Absolutely. And but in addition to that, there is modern technology mixed in. But we still primarily use the hammer, the forge to get the metal hot, and the anvil. And so it's the hand aspect that draws many into the trade. And from there, it's basically up to you to where you can go with it.
I understand you've been commissioned to do some historical restoration work. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have been fortunate to restore and reproduce work of the famed Austrian-born blacksmith Cyril Kulnick, who came to this country in 1893. And rumor has it, or legend has it, that Captain Frederick Pabst asked him to come to Milwaukee. And he's perhaps one of the finest blacksmiths that ever lived. And so I've restored and reproduced works at the Captain Frederick Pabst Mansion, for the Herman Eline Mansion, and other places in and around Milwaukee.
And just briefly, it sounds like you're not alone. You teach classes. Is there a resurgence of interest in blacksmithing?
Yeah, in 1973, the Artist Blacksmith Association of North America was formed, and they're about 5,000 strong. You can find out more about them at www.abana.org. That's ABANA.org. And there's also a British Blacksmithing Association that started in 1978. So, yeah, it's pretty widespread worldwide now.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
That was Dan Nauman, the owner of Bighorn Forge Incorporated. Coming up, two lifelong Shakespeare lovers look back at how the Bard has influenced their life with their new play, The Pleasure of His Company. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we get the latest on information released by WikiLeaks, which has been making likely emails from a Clinton aide public over a week now. But first,
there's another whose warped looks proclaim what stone her heart is made of. Stop her! Ah! George! Ah! Eruption in the flesh! Thou false justicer! Why didst thou let her escape?
Sir, where is the patience now that you so often boasted to retain?
The little dogs, Lenore, Trey, Blanche, and Sweetheart, look no barker.
Tumble throw his head at them. Afore you curse!
That's the voice of Ian McKellen as King Lear. Starting November 3rd, the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison will be host to a traveling exhibit featuring an original edition of Shakespeare's First Folio. Dating back to 1623, the First Folio is a collection of many of Shakespeare's plays that scholars cite as the most reliable version. Two of Shakespeare's most passionate devotees are back in Wisconsin to welcome the First Folio. Randall Duke Kim and Ann Okyogrozo are two of the original three founders of American Players Theater in Spring Green. As for Kim and Okyogrozo, they see Shakespeare as a common thread running through everything they do. The world premiere of their play, The Pleasure of His Company, our 40-year love affair with William Shakespeare, is coming to the Wisconsin Union Theater this Friday at 7 p.m. Randall Duke Kim is an actor of stage, television, and film. He's performed leading roles like Hamlet, Shylock, and King Lear at theater companies around the country. In film, he played the Keymaker in The Matrix Reloaded and the voice of Oogway in the Kung Fu Panda series. Randall, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Hi, Veronica. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much. And also joining us, we have Anne Occhiogrosso, noted artistic director, theater director, and acting coach with special expertise in classical theater and the works of William Shakespeare. At American Players Theater, she directed 16 of Shakespeare's plays and acted in many of them as well. Anne, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Well, Randall, I want to start with you. You've said Shakespeare speaks directly to the human soul. Can you explain more about what you mean by that?
Well, I think he was not a university student, you know, and yet he wrote for the theater and wrote brilliantly. I think he had a common touch, and that common touch is what's kept him alive for so many years now. I think he could see what our human condition was like in very accurate terms. I remember when I was 18, I saw Morris Karnofsky do Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. And for the first time, I saw an actor do a part in which he wasn't acting. What I saw was the character breathing, alive, blood, flesh, and going through his destiny. You know, I don't know. I thought to myself, well, this playwright is a great playwright. He manages to capture a human being in all his complexity, in all the torment and anguish of being a human being. I think there's been no other writer like him in the English language.
And Anne, I'm assuming you agree with most, if not all, of that. And I know that you, too, have spent your life living, as you put it, in the company of William Shakespeare. How do you think that doing that has shaped the person that you are today?
Well, I there's no doubt that I do agree with everything that Randy said. And every facet of my life is affected by those plays. The story that I always tell students and actors that I work with is that I lost my mom when she was rather young, only in her 70s, and it was a devastating loss because we were very close to her. But because I had walked through death with Shakespeare's characters so many times, in the most poetic terms, I was able to cope with that loss with great dignity. And found expressions like, from Pericles, heaven make a star of him, an ease to my aching heart. And so I would say that every time something happens in this world in which we live, there's always a play I can refer to and say, look, it's just like Hamlet, just like Lear, just like Romeo and Juliet. So it's every single day. It's been true from when I was a young girl right into my life today.
I think you said it, Annie. I think he gives comfort. He gives comfort. Unlike many writers, he really touches a soul that needs the comfort. And he certainly has touched my heart that way in moments of great stress and woe and anguish, just like you, Annie.
Mm-hmm. And he always gives us a fair hearing. I think that's the other thing about Shakespeare. We don't give each other a fair hearing, but he does. He does not say life is this way or that way or give us hard and fast rules. He holds that mirror up to every human being that's in that audience so we can see our human nature, and he allows us to decide the effect it's going to have on us.
Yeah,
that's masterful.
I love Shakespeare, but Hamlet is one play I've seen a few times, and a few years ago, I kind of hit a wall with it, and I decided I didn't really need to see it ever again, because I kind of felt like I got it. And then I got lured in to see Benedict Cumberbatch, the actor who plays Sherlock in the BBC series. Anyway, he was playing Hamlet in the National Theater live production, and they played it at a local movie theater, and it was sold out. Here's a little bit of a trailer for that showing.
What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason. How infinite in faculty. In form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust?
A bit of Benedict Cumberbatch playing Hamlet, and after I saw that performance, I realized that I was nowhere near the end of Hamlet, that there was so much more to learn. Randall, is that part of what you love about Shakespeare, that it seems almost like he's bottomless, like there's always new things to discover?
Absolutely. And, you know, just in referring to the that speech, "What a piece of work is man," in the folio, every one of those phrases, "What a piece of work is man," has a question mark after that. "How noble in reason," a question mark. You know, so they're not simple statements describing man. They're actually questions. What a piece of work is man? How noble in reason? How infinite in faculty? In form and moving, how express and admirable? They're questions, because his conclusion at the end of that, near the end of that speech is, "And what is man to me?" You know, it is just dust. Yes, Shakespeare is a bottomless well. The thing about Hamlet is that, yes, we get so tired of it. I mean, we've seen actors writhing on the floor and theatricalizing the role all the time. And yes, it's boring. It's bloody boring. You know, but to see an actor step into a man with a conscience, a prince who's been raised to rule with a conscience, and you sit there wondering as an audience member, my God, why don't our politicians behave like that? Why don't our politicians have consciences like that? They're so ready to go out and send our troops to war, but this prince would have very serious, you know, wrestling matches about that decision. He has a wrestling match about killing his own uncle, of throwing the entire kingdom into chaos by doing such an act. And that's where his hesitations come from. He anguishes over such a terrible decision.
We're talking right now with Randall Duk Kim and Anne Okyo-Grozo. They are Shakespeare experts and actors and directors, and they are two of the three co-founders of American Players Theater in Spring Green, and they're bringing their new play, The Pleasure of His Company, our 40-year love affair with William Shakespeare, to Madison this Friday. And Anne, I want to ask you about that. How did that play come to be? What are you trying to get at there?
I'm sorry, the play?
Right, The Pleasure of His Company. Tell us about that.
Oh, The Pleasure of His Company. I was kind of lost in Hamlet. we were invited to be part of the celebration of the first folio being toured to Wisconsin. And because Randy and I worked directly from that script, we found it irresistible to, Nazi part of it. We were asked if we would do a show that we had recently done, locally, and it was a show about classical actors, and it was a tribute to them. But we decided, because we hadn't been back to Wisconsin in 27 years, that we should devise a piece that was appropriate to Wisconsin, to Madison, to Spring Green, and to all of
I'm going to jump in. You're breaking up on us, your connection. So, Randall, do you want to pick up the thread there?
Well, what Annie was saying was that we've tailored a previous show that we did here in New Jersey as a tribute to all the fine classical actors who have come before us. And what we did was to take a look at that script and say, I think we've got to rewrite large chunks of it so that it's appropriate for the audiences that we'll be playing to in Wisconsin on this one night, you know, to celebrate the folio and to reunite with old friends.
We'll continue our conversation with Randall Duk Kim and Anne Okyo-Grozo in just a moment. They are Shakespearean actors and experts. They founded American Players Theater in Spring Green with Charles Bright. And they're bringing this new play they're telling us about, The Pleasure of His Company, our 40-year love affair with William Shakespeare, to Madison this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Union Theater, the Memorial Union. And we want to hear from you. What does Shakespeare mean in your life, do you think that the work of Shakespeare is still relevant today? Has it changed your life like Randall and Anne were describing? And what is your favorite Shakespeare play and why? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking with Randall Duk Kim and Anne Okyo-Grozo. They spent their careers inspired by and performing the work of William Shakespeare's actors and directors, and they're two of the original three founders of American Players Theater in Spring Green. And they're with us now to talk about Shakespeare and also their new play, The Pleasure of His Company, our 40-year love affair with William Shakespeare. And we'd love to hear from you on this. Does Shakespeare matter to you? Do you think Shakespeare is still relevant in today's world? And if you have a favorite Shakespeare play, tell us what it is and why. Maybe you found comfort in a sonnet or a play of William Shakespeare. Let us know your story. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And right now we'll pick up our conversation starting with Randall. I wonder if you could share one of the memories from the play. I know the play is a collection of memories, some scenes, and just reminiscences. What springs to mind for you?
Well, I had just mentioned Morris Karnofsky. You know, he was a wonderful old actor. He was with the group theater in the 30s, who tried to do something extraordinary in the American theater. But I saw him when I was 18 do Shylock. And that changed, that altered my life. I mean, I knew I was going into the theater, but the kind of acting he did on that stage and how he affected me. I mean, I've never seen a performance where the work was so brilliant that it stabbed me to the heart, that it harpooned my soul, that made me say, ah, that's a human being. That's not just an actor playing at it. It's a real human being. And I've tried to struggle with that kind of acting all of my life, because I don't believe the theater should be just there for titillation and for, you know, just a joke or just a diversion. I want it to mean something. And when you're dealing with great playwrights like Shakespeare or Sophocles or Ibsen or Chekhov or Molière, you want it to mean something, because what they had to say is so important to us as human beings.
And Anne, for you, is part of this, what Randall seems like is getting at there a little bit, is Shakespeare, the works of Shakespeare, sounds like can make you question the way that you live your own life and maybe your own humanity, the decisions you make every day and shaping who you are. Do you see it that way, Anne?
I do see it that way. And again, you have someone like Shakespeare to help guide you. But, you know, it calls for a constant diet of it. I think earlier you were saying that you thought that maybe you had reached your end with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think all audiences should get to see these plays over and over again. You know, Randy and I studied Hamlet 17 years before we did our production at APT. And today, 27 years after we left, we still wake up in the morning after reading something about Hamlet and saying, oh my God, this is what's happening. And then you look at that and you turn on the news and you realize that if everybody had access to these plays done by actors on the live stage, I am telling you, we would be able to meet life so much more heroically and graciously.
Randall, can you think of an example like that where you did maybe take a different course of action than you might have because you thought, you know, Hamlet set such a high bar maybe for morality that I want to live up to that?
Oh, sure. I mean, he does.
But Randy, you should talk about that moment in Lear when he realizes, you know, how where his wealth has led him, where his kingship has led him.
Yes. For example, in the storm scene in King Lear, there's one moment where the old king is left alone in the storm, and he suddenly realizes that he's not alone. He's been turned out by his two daughters, but he's not alone in this. and he addresses poor, naked wretches, your homeless people out there, also enduring the storm, that have no cover for their heads, they're ragged, their clothes are ragged, they are hungry, they're unfed, and the old king suddenly realizes, oh my God, I've taken too little care of this. And then he says, take medicine, pomp, or wealth, you know, you should feel what wretches feel. Then you can show the heavens more just by doing something about it. It's stuff like that we still need to hear. And particularly the wealthy in this world need to hear it. The great Stanislavski said the theater should be for the wealthy. They need to be reminded that there are poor people out there. There are people without their comforts, without their material necessities. And I think the theater should do that. It should remind us, should remind those who are comfortable, hey, things need to get done. There's too much suffering in the world still.
And I want to take a caller now. We've got Kimberly on the line with us in Superior. Kimberly, hi.
Hi there. What a great, great topic. I absolutely love Shakespeare, and I just had a quick little story to share with you. I discovered Shakespeare in high school in my English class. I think I was 16, 15 years old, and we were reading Hamlet. And I believe, and I'm not sure if I'm quoting it directly, but there was a line in Hamlet from Hamlet's mother to him saying, "Thou hast cleft mine heart in twain." And our teacher explained that that was telling Hamlet that he was breaking her heart. And I just had never imagined that language could sound that way and that something so beautiful could mean something in our modern world. It sounded incredible to me, and I have loved Shakespeare ever since.
Oh, that's a great story, Kimberly. Thank you so much. Anne, what does that story make you think of?
Well, it makes me so thrilled because I think so many times we hear the comment that the language is too difficult. But, you know, once somebody like, look, she's 16 when she hears that line and says, gee, that's beautiful, and then finds out that it's a kind of feeling that she knows personally. I think it's wonderful.
And Randall, you spent your whole career doing Shakespeare and a lot of other stuff. For instance, you played the Keymaker in The Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah.
And that's a movie that was a big part of pop culture. It was pretty iconic there.
Yeah.
Was Shakespeare a part of how you played a role like that?
Oh, sure. He never is far away from me. He's always present with me. I mean, what attracted me to The Matrix story was the idea that the world is an illusion. It's an appearance. And that an illusion that we live in, and you know that Shakespeare has that notion too, you know, that a lot of times we walk around and we live our life seeming to be this or that, seeming. It's play acting almost. It's artificial. It's not real. It's not genuine. So Shakespeare is always with me in one way or another, and yes, it was a big pop culture favorite, but I found things in it that were also stimulating. Yeah.
And
you know what's so interesting too is that behind the scenes, while different scenes were being shot on The Matrix, I was sitting off stage, and Keanu Reeves would visit with me, and we would talk about Hamlet. So even actors in the films wanted to, you know, they knew of our background, and they wanted to know more about the plays. So it's not, they don't just turn off their desire to do the great masterpieces when they do film. That curiosity is there right there on the set with all of them.
Well, I want to thank you both so much. It's been wonderful to talk with you today.
Veronica, thank you
so much.
That was Randall Duk Kim and Anne Okeogrozo joining us there. They are nationally celebrated artists specializing in the works of Shakespeare, and they are co-founders, well, actually with Charles Bright of American Players Theater in Spring Green. They're bringing their new play, The Pleasure of His Company, our 40-year love affair with William Shakespeare, to the Wisconsin Union Theater in Madison this Friday at 7 o'clock. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.